Okay, welcome to Free Association. I've got some more videos to play today. This is John Campbell. He uploaded a video last night, which is about misuse of midazolam and morphine-based drugs during the pandemic. So it's a tough subject. This information has been floating around for at least two years. David Icke David Icke's son partly produced a documentary about 2 years ago. I think I covered the midazolam murders. If you look back on my podcast feed, you'll find midazolam related material on there. But this is John Campbell. John Campbell now is a nursing lecturer. So he's an educator. He's a medical educator with 40 years experience. He can't get any more mainstream than John Campbell. And he's asking very serious questions now. So there was 7 minutes of video he posted last night. So, and then there's 20 minutes from this morning. So I'm going to put them both together in one show so that they're all in one place. This is John Campbell.
Monday the 13th of February. Now, I'm going to keep this very brief because there's a serious national question I think we need to be asking ourselves in the UK that applies to the pandemic and ongoing into the future. Did more people die in the pandemic than needed to die? And did some of those die as a result of the medical interventions that were being recommended at the time? Now, I'm going to read you some guidelines that were published on the 3rd of April by the NICE organisation, which basically tells us what to do medically in this country. COVID-19 rapid response. So this is part of their guidelines here. Now, this is managing breathlessness. So this was published, remember, on the 3rd of April 2020. And they say this: consider an opioid and a benzodiazepine. Now, what they mean there is an opium-based drug like morphine, and the benzodiazepine they talk about is midazolam. Now, this is a classical, well-tried, trusted form of treatment that we use for things like terminal agitation, part of terminal care when people are dying of conditions such as cancer and things that are incurable. To manage a peaceful death, and it's completely the right thing to do in the vast majority of circumstances. But what seemed to happen was NICE just took that and transposed that into the COVID situation. And COVID, of course, we know is an infection, and most people can get completely better from it. Was this a fundamental mistake that they made, that they transfer guidelines for incurable conditions onto a potentially completely recoverable condition? It could well have been the case, because if you give these two together, that stops people breathing. Opioids and benzodiazepines will depress respiration. And given that a lot of these people that were breathless anyway had acute respiratory distress syndrome, and you suppress their breathing. So if you have a lot of fluid in your alveoli, you'll get a tachypnea, you'll breathe more quickly to try and compensate. And that can get you enough oxygen into your body to mean that you survive the acute episode. But if you give these drugs, and you get respiratory depression, I don't think you need me to spell out the consequences of that. Not enough oxygen, tissue hypoxia, and death would be the result. So that's what they seem to do. This is the big question mark. So they said, consider an opioid and a benzodiazepine like midazolam combination for patients with COVID-19 who are at the end of life. But how many patients with COVID-19 would be at the end of life unless they had some intractable condition at the same time? And how do you know if they're at the end of life? I've looked after hundreds of patients. You think, good grief, they're not very well. But the vast majority of them survive. With an infective condition, you can't really tell whether it's the end of life or not. How do you tell that with an infective condition? I'm not sure doctors, GPs, certainly without sophisticated diagnostic testing facilities in the community, in the nursing home situation, will be able to tell that. And yet that was the guideline. So how do you tell that at the end of life? I'm not sure that you can. I don't think that you can. and have even, so moderate to severe breathlessness. So some people even with moderate breathlessness. So people that might have looked ill but had a virus that their immune system could have overcome and they could have recovered could well have been given these medications that resulted in suppressing their breathing. So, as I say, at the end of life, moderate to severe breathlessness are distressed. If someone's dying of an intractable condition, fine. If it's a reversible infection, perhaps not. And then the guidelines actually say this, and this is probably the most concerning part of this, really. Sedation and opioid use should not be withheld because of fear of causing respiratory depression. It's almost like saying the respiratory depression is acceptable. And I actually found this quite alarming when I checked it on Wayback Machine. I'm going to do another video with more details, but we'll just leave that there. This is the graphic here from midazolam, for example. So we see that there was a massive increase. So condition that was fairly low there, big increase there when the guidelines came out. Did go down a bit, presumably when doctors realised what was happening. But then a gradual increase that went on all the way into the end of 2022. So I'm just going to show you a few graphics now to illustrate this. And of course, links, the evidence will be in the description. Here's the data from openprescribing.net for various areas in the UK. So we can see up the top there, we've got northeastern Yorkshire. If you want to see your area, plenty more available data is there. But if we look on the left-hand side, we see we've got 8,000, 6,000, 4,000. So that's like 8,000 doses there, plus another 8,000 there, plus another 7,000 there. And you can see these add up to quite really large numbers of doses of midazolam that were given. And of course, we noticed the clear spike in doses, which was round about spring 2020. And we do notice some increased prescribing in most areas. In fact, all areas, a trend upwards throughout the rest of 2020, 2021 and indeed into 2022. Now, this is the openprescribing.net data for levomipromazine. And again, we see a definite spike, which follows closely after the release of the guidelines in spring 2020. And the third one we wanted to look at here was haloperidol. And again, we see a clear spike in the spring of 2020, followed by, I think we'd have to say, increased prescribing on the right-hand side of the graph compared to the left-hand side of the graph. So clear data there that these drugs were prescribed more in a spike and were prescribed more subsequently. So here we see the UK government data on deaths that are attributable to COVID-19, and we see a great spike in the deaths that occurred in spring of 2020. And we notice this consistency from Our World in Data with this large spike in deaths here, confirmed deaths from COVID-19 in spring of 2020. This is associated with the Wuhan variant, and then this large spike here associated with the Alpha variant. But of course, these end-of-life drugs were being prescribed from early April in 2020 all the way through into late 2022. So I'm actually going to leave that there as a fairly short video. I will be putting more details up. But it's actually quite disturbing to think that potentially a lot of people that could have survived didn't survive as a result of the medical interventions that they received.
All right, now I'm going to play the video that he put up this morning. Let me just start it from the beginning again. This is John Campbell.
The second part of the video on unnecessary deaths during the pandemic, we're going to be asking, were there unnecessary deaths during the pandemic? The answer is yes, I'm sure there were. It's not easy for me to make, and it's not going to be an easy watch for you, especially as I know thousands and tens of thousands of you have lost someone during the pandemic. This data applies to the UK. Now, it comes from here. This is from the NICE guidelines published at the time, National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, although the excellent part sounds a little ironic under the circumstances that we're considering. And it was the rapid guidelines for management of symptoms, including end of life in the community of COVID-19, came out on the 3rd of April 2022. And we know that in the spring of 2022, there were a lot of deaths. We see them here. So these guidelines actually came out when? On the 3rd of April, just at the start of this peak here. And the guidelines were still in force during this second peak, this alpha peak. This was basically the Wuhan peak, wasn't it? The alpha peak guidelines were still in force then. And indeed, they were in force all the way up till the end of 2020. So how much these guidelines played a role in the deaths that occurred then is something that we're going to be giving some information to help us to think around. So they're the nice guidelines there. This is the Wayback Machine link. You can get the full document from there. Check it out for yourself. As we said, 31 captures. Actually published on the 3rd, but the first capture was on the 9th of April 2020 all the way through to the 11th of December 2022. I've got here, correlate the use of these drugs with COVID deaths, and we'll be looking at the drugs in a minute. In fact, we'll probably just look at the first one here now. This first one, perhaps the most concerning one, is midazolam. This gives the different areas. So we see what 8,000 prescriptions there, nearly 8,000 prescriptions there, about 7,000 prescriptions there. It adds up to an awful lot. And we see an increase in trend in midazolam prescribing, indeed, as the as 21 and 22 went on. And there's a couple of other drugs we'll be looking at. We normally think of these as end-of-life drugs, but they were prescribed. But the point is, with an infectious condition, you can't tell whether it's end-of-life, unless someone's got some coexisting severe cancer or something. But that will be the vast minority of people who are infected, of course. Because some people with really severe infections simply get better. Sometimes because we treat them, other times because we just give them the time to get better. Here, the end-of-life guidelines that have been used and known about for a long time just seem to have been simply cut and pasted into the COVID situation. And that could well be the tragedy that's becoming clear now. So we know the spike in deaths in spring 2020. And here we have that from the official government data we've just looked at. And from our World in data, we see it as well. The death spikes that occurred in the United Kingdom. And as we said, these treatment guidelines changed around about then, around about there. So to what degree were these deaths here and some of these deaths here attributable to the way that these interventions were in fact delivered is what we're going to be looking at. Now, treatment and care planning. This is from the guidelines. And the first thing that was a little concerning to me here was they wanted to know who had pre-existing advanced directives and not for resuscitation, protocol directives that are standardly used, but they wanted to bring this out. So again, this is for people that have, remember, these infections are potentially reversible. People got better from the infections. The vast majority of people, thankfully, that got infected got better, even people in the much older age groups. But this is what the guideline says. Treatment and care planning for patients with pre-existing advanced comorbidities. Find out if they have advanced care plans or advanced decisions to refuse further treatment. It's almost as if further treatment refusal was being advocated. And the other thing here is that a lot of people in the pandemic had their lives saved with antibiotics because viral infections predisposed to bacterial infections. We're not very good at treating the virus, but we're certainly very good at treating bacterial infections. How many of these patients could have survived with a little bit of oxygen, a little bit of antibiotics, and after a relative period of time, maybe 10 days after the initial onset of the condition some steroids? Is the question. The answer is probably quite a few. Anyway, they wanted to know about this, including do not attempt resuscitation decision. Again, completely standard, but again, sort of cut and pasted into the COVID situation. Doctors, nurses were told to document this clearly and take account of these in care planning. That would be not to resuscitate these patients. Now, treatment for managing cough in adults over 18. Now, some simple treatments are talked about first, but only if the cough is distressing, morphine sulfate. So morphine sulfate, we don't have diamorphine available anymore in injectable form in the UK. At least I haven't had it for, I haven't been had access to it for at least 10 years now. Diamorphine is heroin, but morphine does much the same thing. The morphine sulfate does much the same thing. We just give a slightly higher dose. Oral solution, so 10 milligrams in 5 mils orally. 2.5 milligrams to 5 milligrams when required every 4 hours, increasing to 5 to 10 milligrams every 4 hours. Now, these are relatively 10 milligrams of Oromorph, as we call it, every 4 hours is actually quite a large dose. But just hang on to that information at the moment, because we need to combine that with another thing that was advised. End-of-life treatments for managing breathlessness in patients over 18 years of age. For associated agitation and distress, midazolam. Now, midazolam is a benzodiazepine, 2.5 milligrams to 5 milligrams, subcutaneously via injection when required. But the problem is, if you've got someone who's already got a lung disease, basically a COVID pneumonia, an acute respiratory distress syndrome, and you give morphine, the morphine will cause some respiratory depression. The midazolam will cause some respiratory depression, but give these together and you get, of course, an additive effect. And that's the problem. So the guidelines ended up actually advising morphine in some situations, in combination with midazolam. And combine these two together, and you've got a fairly good chance of getting some respiratory depression. Now, if someone has a pneumonia, there's going to be fluid in their alveoli. They're not going to get the oxygen in and out, so they breathe much quicker to try and compensate. They have a compensatory tachypnea with associated compensatory tachycardia to circulate the blood around the body quicker, exactly the way it should be. And many people, because of these physiological compensation mechanisms, will survive. But if you give midazolam and morphine and you depress the respiration, you prevent that natural compensatory mechanism, and those patients could well die. And that's what the guidelines indicating could be appropriate here. And this was very concerning here. Sedation and opioid use should not be withheld because of fear of causing respiratory depression. Well, it would cause respiratory depression. This is the problem. And I would be terrified to give it in case I cause respiratory depression. But there they said, don't worry about respiratory depression. I find that probably the most ominous part of the whole document, actually. But let's go on and look at what else they're saying here. Managing breathlessness, consider an opioid benzodiazepine combination. Again, the very combination that can inhibit ventilation, that can cause respiratory depression, is what they're recommending. And we don't know that patients are at the end of life with infection, because you really can't tell whether they're at the end of life or not, especially if they only have moderate breathlessness. You can't really tell. And distress, of course, can be temporary. These patients could get better. Consider concomitant use of an antiemetic and regular stimulant laxative. Okay, they're okay. That's normal, other palliative things. But then they go on to say something strange here. They say, at the time of publication, and this doesn't quite add up either, at the time of publication, opioids and benzodiazepines do not have UK marketing authorisation for moderate to severe breathlessness, but they've just recommended it for that. So they seem to be aware that this problem is there, but make these recommendations nonetheless. Now let's look at the drugs that were talked about and where the prescribing increased. Midazolam, benzodiazepine. So there was a spike in midazolam use in 2020, and this increased throughout the rest of 2022. And there it is, that is that data there. And if you want to know more about midazolam, this is the relevant section from the British National Formulary, which will tell you all you need to know there about midazolam. Let's just summarise that from these nice guidelines. They do say important safety information for all benzodiazepines. So this is NICE giving the warning here on its own website, which you might think is somewhat in tension with what they've just said. The official bodies here, MHRA and Committee on something, can't remember that's medicines anyway, that's the Medicines and Healthcare Product Regulatory Authority. But the definitive authorities are saying this, benzodiazepines, that's the midazolam, and opioids. Reminder of risk of potentially fatal respiratory depression. And that came out the month before these guidelines. And yet the guidelines are saying, you know, don't let that stop you prescribing. Give morphine and benzodiazepines and midazolam together, which of course would stop people some people from breathing. Next drug they look at is levomipromazine. This is a phenothiazine drug. I was giving out promazine when I was a teenager to psychiatric patients for schizophrenia. It's a variation, but it's basically a similar drug. Again, spike in use in 2020. Again, this is what we would normally think of an end-of-life drug. An end-of-life tranquilizer. But here we see increasing usage. And the usage, well, it certainly spikes there, doesn't it, when these guidelines came out. These are the different health authorities and the amount that they gave. So it certainly spikes there. And again, if you want to know about it, let's go on to the NICE guidelines that give all the information about it there. I'm just going to summarize the important points here. So it's a phenothiazine neuroleptic, a major tranquilizer. This is quite a potent drug given for restlessness and confusion in palliative care correctly. But as we say, a lot of these patients may not have been palliative. They just had an infection. Nausea and vomiting in palliative care. And of course, it's also used in psychosis, schizophrenia. And the third drug, which has an increase in use at that time, presumably as a result of these guidelines again, is haloperidol. Now, haloperidol is another major tranquilizer. Here we see the increase in use in haloperidol at that time. Again, it's showing it at exactly the same time. And the use increases. So it increases here, and the use uses are higher there. See, we've lit up north, NHS Devon there, and the other authorities there. There's definitely a trend towards increasing use after the spring of 2020. And again, all the information about haloperidol is here, again, in the British National Formulary. Check it out. Make sure I'm not making this stuff up. So this is haloperidol, spike in use again, as we've seen. Nausea and vomiting in palliative care, used for schizophrenia and schizoaffective. That's affective is where there's an affective component like depression or mania or hypomania. And acute delirium, when non-pharmacological treatments are ineffective. In other words, when patients become difficult to manage. Delirium being an acute confusional state. But of course, acute confusional states can be exacerbated by hypoxia. And there, the correct treatment is to reverse the cause of the hypoxia, not simply to suppress the treatment. So there's real questions to be asked about people that put these guidelines up. These are the official NICE guidelines. National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. So, how many of these deaths were COVID deaths and how many of these deaths were iatrogenic deaths? looking at the great increase in deaths that we saw when these guidelines were around. So these guidelines were around during this second large peak in deaths here, and for the end, the guidelines actually came out on the 3rd of April, so we can see it applies to quite a lot of that Wuhan wave's peak as well. This question, unfortunately, is open. How many of these deaths were COVID? How many of these deaths were iatrogenic? Now, iatrogenic means caused by medical treatment. So iatros is Greek for doctor, doctor caused, or any medical treatment. How many of these deaths were iatrogenic? How many people would have survived if the doctors and the nurses had simply not called to see them? Is really, okay. How many of these deaths were iatrogenic? I mean, we know this happened in Sweden. Sweden panicked and started giving morphine and midazolam. And many of those patients were relatively young and could have recovered. And yet the same thing seems to have happened in the UK. To what degree this happened in the States, other countries have been able to collect that data. But it's fundamental. You treat the underlying cause of the condition wherever you can, not simply suppress the symptoms. If you have a splinter in your finger, I could give you some intravenous morphine, I could give you a local anaesthetic, and the pain would go away. I could treat the symptoms. Or, of course, I could pull the splinter out. Treat the cause. This is basic stuff. How many of these deaths were iatrogenic? And again, I apologise if you've lost someone in circumstances that you can relate to this. I know this is not an easy watch. For someone who spent their 44 years in healthcare, it's not easy to make. It just sort of seems to go against so many fundamental axioms that have. But to precisely what degree did this make COVID look more deadly than it was? So if some of these deaths were iatrogenic, then they weren't caused by COVID. They were caused by nurses and doctors squirting drugs into people. How did that affect future policies? How did this artificially inflate death data and national policy and all the harms done by subsequent national policies, pharmacological and non-pharmacological? So for those of you that have lost people in this pandemic, I know that's difficult to watch because basically the fact of the matter is these drugs can bring about death in people who had infections that could have recovered. And it really is an indictment of how dependent so many of our healthcare providers have become on simply following guidelines. The recommendations in this guideline represent the view of NICE arrived at after careful consideration of the evidence available. When exercising their judgment, professionals and practitioners are expected to take this guidance fully into account. And there you go. It says, if you work in this field, you should take this guidance fully into account. And if you go against the guidelines, if something goes wrong, what did you go against the guidelines for? Evidence-based medicine should be based on the empirical evidence-based data. It should be based on expert medical opinion, and it should be based on patient preferences. It seems to me that these last two have completely flown out the window, and it's really, it really shouldn't be like that. Evidence-based medicine is the empirical evidence base, expert medical opinion, and patient preferences. We need to get back to that, I think. So there we go. Look at that for yourself. And my sincere condolences to anyone who's been affected by this. And thank you for watching.
Okay, so that's John Campbell. That's the last two videos that he's posted. He's obviously very distressed about this, so but once he gets something in his head, he won't let go of it. We know that from his past videos. So there will be more, and he will keep going. He will keep mentioning it, and he will keep pushing it until somebody in authority takes a look at it, or it gets raised in Parliament or whatever. But as I said, this information has been floating around for at least a couple of years. I've known about this stuff for at least a couple of years. But that's it for now. I'll cover John Campbell's coverage of it. Because I watch his videos anyway. I like what he does. He's obviously got a lot of experience, but he's late to the party with this one. But he has got there. And that's as important as the timing, is at least he got there. He got there by thinking about it and by looking at evidence, which means that other people with that level of experience will get there by thinking about it and looking at evidence. And also, it's safe now to post this sort of thing. It wasn't safe 2 years ago. His channel would have been taken down immediately if he'd posted this stuff 2 years ago. So he's kind of insulated himself from YouTube guidelines quite successfully. But he does get there and he does ask questions. I think we need to give him credit for that, even if he is late. Because there has to be... Some people will be late. Some people will get there early. And obviously they get a jackboot on their head and they get banned from everywhere and ridiculed. Some people get there later. And they've survived the jackboot by avoiding having the conversations. And then they can start raising stuff in relatively mainstream places like YouTube. Anyway, that's enough from me. I think he's said everything very clearly. I don't have the experience or the expertise to be able to do this stuff, so I'm relying on people who do. But that's enough for now. I'll post more coverage and I'll post more of John Campbell's material on here as and when it's appropriate.